Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And welcome to this episode of Music from the Tower. This is your host, John Romeri, and today's tower is filled with great musicians, and we have one right here for us. Dr. Tony Alonzo. Welcome, Tony. It's good to have you.
Thank you, John. It's amazing to be here.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe you are on our campus. It's so great you're here for the RE Congress, our Religious Ed Congress of Los Angeles that's in Orange County, but we won't tell them. They seem to not notice. But it's always so good because we have so many guests and visitors coming into our studios and onto our campus, and we're always delighted when the Congress is going on. It's just wonderful.
So it's my delight, and to see this incredible campus, it's so exciting to see what's happening
great
here.
Great to have you. It's going to be really one of America's premier cathedrals. It really is. We have a double legacy here. We have, of course, the legacy of what every great Catholic cathedral is to be, but we also have the incredible eyes of all of the people who knew Dr. Schuller, when we bid on this campus, not everybody thought we would even get it, and we weren't the highest bidder.
Yeah.
But it was his choice to keep it a place where God is worshipped and not turn it into a college campus or something else. So we really feel his presence and the need for us to respect what went on here, and certainly music was a huge part of it.
It's incredibly hopeful to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Well, Tony, you are a published composer. You're a college professor. We want to hear about all of this. You know, you're a parish musician with one of my dearest friends, Jeffrey Bush. You're a volunteer parish musician. I love that this incredibly talented musician is just a volunteer in his little parish. That's a riot. So tell us about music. How did it come into your life? Where was it? Who gave it to you? Who gave you those gifts of music?
Yeah, my earliest musical memories are of my three aunts on my mom's side singing every Christmas Eve in three-part harmony Christmas carols.
Wow.
And, you know, there's nothing like
most relatives can't carry a tune.
Right.
You've got three to sing in harmony.
Yeah. And it was the first time I think I had an experience of live music on a regular basis and hearing just voices singing independent harmonies. And I was absolutely transfixed by what I now realize were pretty basic, but to me, they were just amazing.
Yeah.
And so being surrounded by music from a young age was probably the thing that first got me into all of this.
And were they singing it at church or just around the tree? Or
no, they would just sing around the tree. My grandfather would demand that they sang something every Christmas, so they would get singing. And one of those aunts heard me singing around the house, you know, like the way kids do, like just nursery rhymes and humming songs that they were singing. And when she was getting married, I was in the third grade, and she asked if I would sing in her wedding.
Wow, third grade.
Yeah, to which my mother said, "You don't want a third grader to sing at your wedding. Are you crazy?" Because my mom didn't, you know, have any real connection to it. And she said, "Well, let me give him the sheet music, see if he can take it to the local music teacher and have her teach it to him and see. And if it doesn't work out, no problem. But I think he can sing. I think he's musical." And so I did. It was One Hand, One Heart from West Side Story.
I was just going to say, do you remember what it was?
I do, which is a music director I would not allow.
But yes, of course not. Yes, I fall on the floor.
Right.
But there you were, singing into the hearts of millions.
Exactly. God works in and in spite of us. So that was my first real musical experience, was singing as a third grader at her wedding.
So you heard it here first on Music from the Tower. His premier first adventure as a parish musician was singing One Hand, One Heart from
exactly.
I love it.
It began with illicit songs. And then I was always very interested in the music we sang in church. I would page through the hymnals, like looking at the number board up front, like, what are we going to sing today? And who wrote it? And when was it written?
If only we had a full congregation of those people, right?
Or not.
Yeah.
It takes all kinds, truly. But I was very interested, and I had a fourth grade teacher who heard me sing, kind of serendipitous, actually, in a school presentation. And she was starting a kids choir at our very tiny Catholic church, and she asked me to sing in it. And so that was my first connection to church music, really.
And what a place. I mean, I know with my own children's choirs over the years, that's the place that you nurture them into, you know, all sorts of things, like our own David Ball, who became, you know, I moved him from piano to organ, and the next thing you know, he's playing for the choirs, and next thing you know, he's a professional musician serving the church. You know, it's pretty amazing. So did you go on to college and high school as a music major?
Yeah, I went to Northwestern University in Evanston for a vocal performance, ended up with a degree in choral conducting, actually. And worked at churches.
And who was your teacher there?
They had Robert Harris.
Yeah, they was my very famous choral conductor there.
And I was working in Catholic churches around the Archdiocese of Chicago.
As a parish musician?
As a parish
during your
musician.
College days?
Yep, the entire time.
And what about afterwards? Then what?
And so when I
full-time
was
full-time church work?
Yeah, when I was a senior in college, I began ministering at a church in Evanston, where Northwestern is, called St. Nicholas. And it had an incredible liturgical legacy. The pastor was Bob Oldershaw, who has long and rich GIA connections.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So he hired me at 21 years old to be the music director. And I was like, you really want a 21-year-old directing? But he always had this kind of expansive vision. You could see sparks in people and say, I can work with you on the liturgy stuff.
There's a spark in you, that's for sure.
So he grabbed me up. And Gabe Huck was a parishioner there.
Oh my gosh, you really had, it was Mecca.
Yeah, it was kind of a liturgical Mecca, and really began in earnest my liturgical formation. I had the musical formation from Northwestern, but they taught me so much about liturgy.
I bet, yeah. I bet. And were you just the choir director and the music director? Did you also play the organ? Did you play the guitar, piano? What other instruments do you play?
So I was the director of music. I played the piano and directed the choirs, played the organ. I always say that I love the organ so much that I don't play it very often. I usually have other people play it so that it's done well. But we were a very diverse community as well. So we had Spanish mass, English masses. We worshiped together bilingually. So that also gave me my first taste of working in a real diverse community.
And you spoke Spanish, right?
Yeah. My father is born in Cienfuegos, Cuba, came over to Miami when he was 6 years old. As we discussed earlier, my mom is from Minnesota. So the hot and the cold live on in me.
Yeah.
The stoic nature and the passionate nature live on in me. And the music lives on in me in very different ways, kind of shaped by that Minnesota liturgical ethos and, you know, the
choral music
everywhere. I think the legacy of, you know, St. John's in Collegeville, St. Olaf's,
all of those places.
It really kind of like finds its way everywhere into high schools and churches, and it's an amazing legacy. And then, of course, from my Cuban side, I had a deep love for all of this completely different stylistically sounding music. So that was helpful when I started that work in parish ministry.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime when I was at the cathedral in St. Louis, any choir that would come visiting us that came from Minnesota or up that way, you knew they were going to be amazing. The choral singing up there was just, you know, and they've had world choir symposiums and all that stuff. You know, when you think of the great musicians that have been in Minneapolis and the cathedral and St. Paul.
Yeah, I have to say it spoiled me every time I'm somewhere now and they say, we have an amazing lessons and carols. And I'm like, I grew up going to the St. Olaf.
Well, that's wonderful. And so, but where did academia come from? Did you, now you're there with a music degree, and did you think that was your end goal or?
Not at all.
Yeah.
No, I always like that quote, if you want to see God laugh, plan your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So I worked at that church in suburban Chicago for 6 years. And then moved out to Los Angeles, actually, down the road to Loyola Marymount University.
What a great place. Was Paul Solomonovich still there?
No, Paul had moved on by then.
Okay.
Mary Braden was the director of choral activities.
Fabulous.
And I was the director of the music for the chapel. And that was another incredible experience. You know, the church, so vibrant, as you know, here in Orange County, also in Los Angeles. And the opportunity to work with a kind of a concentrated demographic, 18 to 22-year-olds, was also a completely new experience for me. Although I was pretty young when I took the job, I learned a lot from that experience about the diversity of young people, the tendency that we sometimes have to stereotype, characterize what quote-unquote young people like, which is doomed to failure because they're as diverse as any other group in terms of what they respond to. And it was there that I decided to pursue a master's degree in theology simply as a way to deepen my ministry, not really with any designs on academia. I thought it would be helpful for my songwriting, my liturgical sensibilities. So my master's is actually from LMU.
Okay. All right. So we've got a little LA tie here. That's fabulous.
For sure.
And your doctorate, where was that done?
My doctorate is from Emory University in Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah, which is where I am now.
Everywhere you go, you pick up a degree while you're there. I like it.
It feels like it. It's very unexpected. My grandfather was kind of an intellectual in Cuba, politician, lawyer, and he always wanted me to go on to get what he would call my papeles, my papers. You need your papers. You need more papers. Never really interested me, but it kind of ended up happening very organically for me, just out of kind of intellectual curiosity. And I ultimately moved to Emory to study with Don Saliers, who's an incredible theologian and musician. And he was willing to take me on as a student. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to the South. I knew no one there, but the opportunity to work with Don is just something I couldn't pass up.
He was one of the great ones in the ecumenical movement, that's for sure. And when I was on the chair of the AGO Ecumenical Committee or whatever, I mean, we featured him at so many conferences because he was so learned. He could speak well. He wrote well. You know, he could deliver a paper. He was just a real genius of that. And so you went there to study with him? Not for a position, not for a job?
No, I went there to get my PhD, and I was very seriously considering a couple of Catholic schools that I love, and it was hard to not go to them, but the opportunity to study with someone who was such a kindred spirit that brought together the music and the theology was just, I couldn't pass it up.
He got it. You know,
he did. He just gets it. Yeah.
He just gets it. And what a treat for us that you got that. You know, isn't it great to look back to the people that gave us these gifts, you know, these incredible gifts that come right from someone like a Don or someone like a Mary Braden, all of these people that just have passed on this and made you who you are, you know, so that you can give it away to millions of students. And well, one of the things we're going to talk more about is your love of composition and the great pieces you've given to our church. So let's hear one, shall we?
Sure. This is one of my earlier pieces, actually, that emerged from that community in Chicago. I co-wrote it with Gabe Huck. He wrote the words. He was just kind of leaving LTP at the time and was looking for things to do. I said, well, here, why don't you write some hymn texts? And we were experimenting with different forms of singing. And this is a communion song called From the Many, Make Us One.
All right. And we'll be right back and hear so much more from Dr. Tony Alonzo. Stay tuned. Don't go away.
Jesus prayed before he died.
To this single now we come.
Make them one, this whole world wide.
From the many make us one.
Every shade and tribe and tongue.
To this single now we come.
Male and female, old and young.
From the many make us one. When we sing and when we cry, as we live and as we die, to this table now we come. From the many make us one.
Jesus washed their feet and cried,
to this table now we come.
Grieved the deeds that would divide,
from the many make us one.
Thou wast down now each to one,
to this table now we come.
Make this world a banquet hall.
We'll be right back with more from your host, John Romeri,
and his special guests on Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to Music from the Tower. We are enjoying a wonderful hour today with Tony Alonzo. Tony is a name that even if you don't know by name, you have sung some of his music. He's one of the great composers in our church today. Hymnals are filled with his music. And I just can't believe you're right here with us. And we're talking about, in this segment, about being a composer. What's that like? You know, I mean, where do you start? Do you start with text? Do you start with a melody that's in your head? I feel like some of our composers are really more songwriters. I don't classify you that in that category. I would classify you in the composer category. But I do feel like some have songs in their head. They find a melody. They jury-rig our liturgical text to match it. And all of a sudden, we're not singing glory to God in the highest, but we're singing glory, glory, glory to God in the highest, glory, glory. And I feel a little put off by songwriters sometimes. You're looking at the harmonies, the musical structure is not traditional, you know, the voice leading's poor, the accompaniments are not good. So how did composing become a part of your life? From necessity or just you were looking for things that weren't out there, so you decided to tackle it yourself?
Yeah, I would say my earliest attempts were exactly that, attempting to fill gaps in the repertoire as a parish music director who found that there were tons of settings of certain scriptural passages, certain psalms, certain themes, and a kind of dearth, on the other hand, of a lot of others. And so my earliest attempts were like setting psalms that nobody wanted to set and not so much doing it to create the most amazing thing ever composed, but something that we could do, you know, next weekend with the resources that we had. So my very first compositions emerged out of that kind of need. Now, I hope, I mean, I've tried to commit.
So you started with text?
Oh, yeah. And I was going to talk about this a little more. Your questions really got me thinking about how I really see the vocation of the liturgical composer needing to conform to a series of commitments, really. We work under constraints, right? Which is different than other art
forms.
Well,
some do, some don't.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I see myself serving, having a few fundamental commitments. One is to the liturgy itself, right? What are the structural demands? What does the liturgy itself need at this particular moment? Why does this particular form work here and not there? So serving the liturgy. I see myself as a servant of the word, like any preacher. I'm from working at a good Protestant university where we really take seriously our preaching.
It's important.
And music preaches.
Right.
It can subvert.
Nobody goes home humming the sermon.
Exactly.
How many times have we heard that?
That's true. You know? And just like
the theology that we put in people's mouths,
Yeah. Sometimes
you can tell parish musicians or even composers are not thinking about that.
Right.
You know, you read it and you think, oh, that was a pretty melody, but what does this even remotely say?
Yeah.
You know, and here we are singing away.
That's right. I mean, and, you know, music can profoundly subvert scripture. It can enhance it. It can illuminate it. It can simply kind of present it like a chant does in some ways, but it can also subvert it in problematic ways.
Yeah.
So I think
make it trite sometimes.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Or even maybe just completely change the meaning of it. I think of the temptation sometimes to determine the quote unquote meaning of a psalm based on the antiphon. And sometimes that can be really misleading, like a Psalm 90. If the antiphon is "fill us with your love, O God, and we will sing for joy," and you don't pay attention to the text as a whole, you're missing the fact that that is a lament.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that comes from knowing scripture.
Yeah.
You know, and so taking your theological background and superimposing that on your composition is a real plus for all of us who benefit from your compositions.
Thanks. And I mean, I say all this as a kind of a self-critique. There are certainly things that I have written that have not done that have not taken that seriously. And it's regrettable to me. And that's
once you put it out there, there it is.
That's
right?
It. I mean, I got published at 21 years old and it stays out there even if you've gone in a different direction or gone further.
Do you ever go back and re-edit something or say, I really want to republish this? Or
occasionally other things, I hope they just kind of quietly fade away.
Fade away.
So, you know, servant of the liturgy, servant of the word. I think we're servant of the people of God. Right. Much of the music that I write is written for ordinary, everyday Catholics to sing in their communities. And my question
it's not
is,
a range too low, too high, too difficult.
Yeah, and that's tricky, because how do you write something that's accessible enough that people can sing it, but also interesting enough that they want to sing it?
Or worthy of the liturgy.
And worthy of repetition, like you've talked about so often in this podcast. And I don't know that I always get it right, but I always am thinking about that.
I think of somebody like Domenico Bartolucci, who was the director of the Sistine Choir for so long, and we didn't all love his sound, but we all loved him.
Yeah.
You know, he was a great man and a wonderful composer for himself, because I feel sorry for composers today, because what they have to write is like trying to get the whole Sistine Chapel on a postage stamp.
Mm.
You know, I mean, a Palestrina could write a Sanctus that took 10 minutes. And we have to write one that's 16 measures long. And it has to be good. It has to be interesting. It has to bear the repetition of liturgy week after week, mass after mass. But yet has to be singable. Has to be... Palestrina didn't worry about how singable it was. He had a fabulous Sistine Choir. You know, so the constraints on composers are enormous, I think. You know, you've got to think about text. You've got to think about the quality of the writing. We heard from our friends at GIA not long ago on this show that, you know, you've got to think about, will it sell? That's a whole nother dimension, right? As you're writing it, a piece, do you think, will anybody buy this? Or, gosh, I made that verse too hard. I better simplify that. Or do they come back ever to you and say, that's too hard, make it easier?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think when you write liturgical music, people are always coming back to you and giving you their feedback. I always joke that I think people feel most viscerally about two things in life, and one is food and the other is music.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can't imagine tasting that thing on that person's plate, and they can't understand why you wouldn't want to eat it. I think the same thing is true about music, especially church music. So I hear all kinds of feedback, much of which I find actually extremely helpful, and I've tried to be open to as much as I can be. I'll tell you what the most interesting thing for me has been. Since I went on for my PhD at Emory, it was the first time in my adult life that I was not a regular parish music director. So I was going to church as a full conscious active member of the assembly, the church.
That's not always easy, is it?
No, it isn't. And as we talked about earlier, Immaculate Heart of Mary in Atlanta is my parish. But it was also incredible.
You chose wisely.
Thank you. But it was also incredibly informative to sing as a member of the assembly as opposed to the person in charge of everything.
Yeah.
It helped me think differently. I was really attentive to what was working and what wasn't working, not just up front, but also in the midst of the people with whom I was singing in the assembly.
Were they singing it, or was it just something that Jeff liked and that's why we chose it? You know, I love that piece.
Which we're all at risk of.
That's one of our motives. We love it and we want to do it.
Yeah. And our, you know, own proximity and kind of prominent place means we don't always have that experience. And so that really helped begin to shape my liturgical music differently. I wrote a mass setting for Immaculate Heart, Mass of Christ, Light of the Nations. And I really benefited, unlike the first round, where we all kind of wrote without any idea of how these texts were going to feel in the voice of the assembly, because we weren't permitted to pray them before they were published,
right. Basically.
But
yet we all needed these new mass parts. It was a weird time, wasn't it?
It was so
strange. As a parish musician, you know, and I can't tell you how many parish musicians I was in the diocese of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia at that time, and their big thing was, I'd never want to sing Mass of Creation again. And about 4 months later, somebody came and he goes, the only good one left is Mass of Creation. You know, I mean, it was amazing how everybody couldn't wait for something brand new, and this was our moment in time, and we got piles of Mass. I had a whole committee to select the diocesan setting that we were going to do. And we got a lot of pressure to sing the ISIL chants and what that was going to look like. I think every diocese kind of went through that discernment. Are we going to sing those? And how do you dress them up for Chrism Mass? And, you know, they're so simple. And, you know, what do you do? And some diocese mandated that they sing that for one entire year. I remember that some of our colleagues were saying that. But it was a very odd time that all of a sudden we had no common language. Lots of people wrote their own masses. So now you had a diocese with 50 mass settings going on at once. You couldn't go to anybody's church and sing a funeral or a wedding or, wherever you went as a pew potato, there was no, it's like, okay, don't know that one, never heard of that before. Then you found out it was written by the guy at that parish. It's very, very, it was a very tricky time in our history, wasn't it?
It was. And I think it's because we were trying to do something without the benefit of any real pastoral sense of how these texts worked. And that's not the best way to be writing liturgical music, to be honest with you. I mean, I think the best liturgical music comes out of a deep connection to scripture, deep connection to liturgical texts. And we really didn't have that. We had a book of texts and everyone went to their homes and or to their studios or whatever and
figured it out,
figured something yeah. out.
And now, 10 years later, or however long it is, 8 years later, the good ones have risen to the top and the others have dropped away. And, I know some of the publishers, I don't want to see any mass settings. I don't want any more mass settings for a while. And now it seems like they're starting to entertain, mass settings and mass parts because we had such a proliferation of them there for a while. It was unbelievable. Well, I think we need a little bit more music, shall we? What do you got for us?
This is an arrangement of the hymn Jerusalem, My Happy Home from a recent collection I did called Revival, contemporary arrangements of traditional hymns. And contemporary and traditional can mean many things to many people.
Oh, it certainly does, doesn't it? It's amazing what traditional means.
Yeah, so I won't get too far into that. But for me in this collection, it meant trying to present some of the beautiful heritage of hymnody that has spoken across Christian denominations in a style that made sense for pianists and guitarists and, the arrangements for oboe, cello, and whatnot. Because so many of the accompaniments in our hymnals are organ-based, they don't necessarily translate. Not everyone has the gifts to translate them to the piano. So this is one of those arrangements of one of my very favorite hymns.
And is this instrumental?
Instrumental and vocal.
Oh, okay. So the words are there.
Yeah, and it's intended to accompany or lead congregational song.
Very good. Jerusalem, My Happy Home. We will be right back with so much more from Dr. Tony Alonso. Stay tuned. Don't go away.
Jerusalem, my happy home, when shall I with you be? When shall my sorrows have an end? Your joys, when shall I see?
You're listening to Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio. Happy to be able
deeper labor out of mind and sight. But choirs of angels heard the mother's weeping, and heaven rang with songs of peace on earth. They went on earth came among the outcasts at his birth. An angel came to Joseph in his dream and warned him so song and stories never to be told.
Welcome back. This is Music from the Tower, and we just heard a piece called O Weary Couple. This was a piece written by Tony Alonzo. It's a Christmas piece, right, Tony? Tell us about it.
It is. This is a text by Mennonite hymn writer Adam Tice, who's just written a ton of music that people across Christian denominations have been using, I'd say, over the last 5 or 10 years.
Mm.
And this is a piece about the fact that the Holy Family were themselves refugees. And it's so it's a piece that connects with the Christmas story with that reality. I always have to laugh because my friend and colleague John Bell from the Iona community in Scotland is fond of saying that, you know, so much of our music we sing at Christmas is so romantic and not necessarily theologically accurate.
No, but the picture of it all
is lovely. And he says, if you were given birth in a barn, would it be a silent night for you?
Yeah.
Which I think is a good question, as much as I like Silent Night. And I think this is a song, this is a text that really connects us with the messy reality of the incarnation, both in history and in the present moment. The tune is actually not mine. It's actually, I will confess, one of my least favorite tunes. It's to London Derriere.
Oh, my.
Which has been sung terribly at churches
so many ways throughout the world
to the text, O Danny Boy. So I found a particular challenge of rendering this tune in a way that didn't have that kind of maudlin.
Well, to take us someplace else.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I really enjoyed that challenge, and I'm happy with how the piece turned out. And it's been sung pretty widely over the last couple of years.
It's beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. And you recorded that right here in L.A., right?
I did. A lot of the stuff that I record, I still come back to Los Angeles. I mean, we just have so many resources musically in this
area. It's an amazing area. You know, I didn't know what to expect moving here from Philly, and I kind of came in a little snobby, I must admit. You know, it's like, is the Pacific Symphony going to be as good as the Philadelphia Orchestra? And, you know, but I'm just thrilled to be here in the midst of, you know, L.A. Master Chorale and L.A. Philharmonic and Pacific Chorale, and we've just got one great ensemble after the other and some astonishing music going on in our parishes.
And people making music across genres. I mean, you have people from the L.A. Phil playing on films, playing on...
Well,
you know,
yes, there's that whole thing. You know, I will go to a rehearsal for Chrismass. Oh, I'm so happy to play this music. I've been doing horror films all day.
Exactly. You know? In fact, the producer and engineer of the song we just heard, A Weary Couple, his primary work is on horror films.
Wow.
He just finished...
Well, he had some of my instrumentalists just that afternoon.
And he often says the same thing. He's like, oh, it's a nice to have a relief to record something melodic.
But they're fabulous musicians who can play in any direction.
That's right.
You know, I mean, they're just as at home doing the Perry I Was Glad as they are doing some film score that John Williams wrote. You know, it's just, it's wonderful.
That's right.
It's wonderful. Well, we didn't talk as much about your college career. So now you have your PhD and you just stayed on at Emory?
Yeah, it was quite a significant decision because I really saw moving to Atlanta as like going away to college. And then
you would come back.
Exactly,
you know,
or go somewhere
else.
Right?
Right.
Around the time I was finishing up my dissertation, the dean at our School of Theology, which is United Methodist at its foundation, asked me to a meeting where she wanted to talk to me about the fact that she wanted to launch a Catholic Studies program, which was an incredible thing. I don't think that's happened, a Catholic Studies graduate program on the master's level from a Protestant school. I don't know of any kind of parallel. But what it speaks to is the fact that, like here in Southern California, the Catholic Church is growing. Even though all of our historical infrastructure is in the Northeast and the Midwest, the people are now in the South and the West.
Right.
And we believe that we're the largest Catholic archdiocese in the country without a Catholic university. And so we saw an opportunity to serve the Catholic community,
exactly right.
Which is incredibly diverse. So I am the director of our brand new Catholic Studies program.
How brand new is brand new?
It launched in September.
Oh, okay. That's really brand new.
And by launched, I mean we're just kind of advertising for next academic year, really. So we'll see the first students in our Catholic Studies program in earnest come next fall.
So you've spent this year developing the curriculum?
That's exactly right.
And, wow.
Yep. And then I'm also an assistant professor of theology and culture, and I teach pretty widely in liturgy, sacramental stuff, and practical theology.
And do you also make music at school?
It's much like my work at Immaculate Heart of Mary. When the musicians at our seminary call upon me to sing a song or play something, I'm more than happy to do it, but it's actually not my primary responsibility.
Okay, so you're not the conductor of a choir?
Nope.
Okay, and that's not a little yearning going on there?
There is definitely a little yearning that goes on there.
Yeah, okay, all right. Will there be a Catholic choir as part of this Catholic Studies? Will there be chapel services?
Are possible. We have regular chapel services on Tuesdays and Thursdays, which are ecumenical and happen in a wide range of styles. We have celebrated Catholic Masses. In fact, the very first Mass we celebrated at Candler School of Theology for like 10 people. Was celebrated by Cardinal Kurt Koch from the Vatican, who was visiting, giving a lecture, and we asked him if he would preside at Mass. So I thought it was cool.
Did you make the music for that?
I did. In our tiny chapel,
okay.
I played the piano. We did most of it a cappella. But it was lovely. It's exciting to be a part. I see a lot of parallels here of being in a place where the church is growing in a time when we hear a lot of narratives of decline about the church in other areas. That's not the story you want to tell here.
I've never been in a parish that says, please don't come early.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's just no physical room for the people. And this is a 36-acre campus.
Yeah.
But there's so many people coming to Mass that, you know, you open the door and there's no way to get out because the people are there at the door ready to come in for the next Mass.
That's right. It's a counter narrative to what's happening in
completely different
the country.
And because my wife was living in Philly and I would go home to my home and in Philly there to be with kids and grandkids, and you know, you'd go to Mass going, I wouldn't even turn on the organ for these 200, you know. It's like, are you kidding? You only got 200? And Karen going, big crowd today at 10, you know. But it's a whole different paradigm, isn't it?
It is. I mean, at our Easter Vigil at Immaculate Heart of Mary, I mean, we're initiating like 20 people every year. I would say 75% of those are from the Latino community.
Mm-hmm.
So that has implications for how we pray. But yeah, it's a story of growth.
We have two vigils with over 50 catechumenates.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's just, there's no way to get them all in one space.
Yeah.
And we've tried, but no go. Even in the new cathedral, I don't think it'll work with lots more seats.
Yeah, it's nice to have stories like this in
the
world
right
now.
Yeah, it is. It's very hopeful for the church, but very scary for what music is, you know, and how do you make music? I feel a great responsibility here because people are watching. You know, how's he handling this? How's it working? How is he bridging music? How is music not being something that divides us, but something that unites us? And we've tried to take melodies and translate them. We've tried to take a chant and unify us through the chant and singing it in different ways, but the same melody. There are all sorts of ways. And so what will the focus of the Catholic studies be at your school?
My primary hope is that we'll be able to form the next generation of leaders who will be, you know, directors of religious education, Catholic school teachers, liturgists for our region. Because right now we import a lot of folks from other places.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that's largely because we don't have the infrastructure to form the people we have.
Well, and everybody there can't just take a few years off and go somewhere.
Exactly.
You know? You want to have a place where they can study and study with something that's going to be of quality, not to just have another piece of paper, but to have something that's going to be super practical in their work.
That's right. And so I'm also encouraging folks, even from outside our region, to say, hey, if you want to study where the church is growing,
come
be with us. Come be in our parishes. It's a different reality.
Well, and Emory has such a good reputation for music.
Yes.
You know, the organ there is so beautiful. And,
yep.
You know, there are great things happening there. And the city of Atlanta is so vibrant. And, you know, when I think of Immaculate Heart of Mary and the beautiful organ that they put in with that church, you know, that's a great sign that things are alive and well.
Yeah, we are surrounded by music at Emory and in Atlanta. I mean, since I've been there, we've had everything from the St. Olaf Choir to Paul Simon come through our concert
hall. Isn't
that
great?
Just fantastic.
Yeah, I just love that parish. I was there for the dedication of the organ, got to play it myself later on, and was so pleased to see Jeff's wonderful program that's going. And I know lots of other musicians in that area as well, who are transplants from Pittsburgh. A couple of Phil Barecas there.
Yes, that's right.
And Michael Malunk. There are some just fabulous people that work down that way. And let's hear some more music, shall we?
Sure. This is a piece of mine called Litany of Mary. It's a trilingual piece, so it's English, Spanish, with Latin responses based on Immaculate Mary. We talked a little bit earlier when we were talking with the GIA folks about not only do Latinos have many musical expressions, but they have many Marys.
They certainly do.
And I'm sure you
see
that here.
We have them all parading around the campus.
Exactly. So I've always wanted to find a kind of that Litany of Loreto, that traditional chant that we could sing a setting of throughout the liturgical year for Marian feasts. So this is a very simple setting. Reflecting, going back to the earlier conversation about commitments, that commitment to finding things we can all sing as a community together.
We will be right back. There's so much more to talk about with Tony Alonso here in the studio. What a great gift to us. And please stay tuned. Our next segment, we'll find out what's coming up next in his life, what projects he's working on musically. All right, stay tuned. This is Relevant Radio, and you're listening to Music from the Tower.
Thank you for listening to Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our last segment of the show with Tony Alonso, Dr. Tony Alonso, college professor, musician, pew potato. He's in the pews at Immaculate Heart of Mary Church. So, you know, we've learned so much about you, but what's next? what's next for you? You know, do you have a piece that you haven't written that you're just dying to write? Is there a text you haven't played with? Have you written any kind of a major work? Are you looking to write something with more context? Do you have something that's going on for your degree program? Tell us what's the next chapter for you.
Yeah, so of course, as a newly hired tenure track professor, the answer is always, my book is next. So I'm actually working on that and have a deadline coming up for my more academic writing.
Do we get to find out the title of that right here on Music from the Tower? Does it have a title yet?
Yeah, I'm working on the title. It's about Eucharist and consumer culture and their interrelationship. Okay. We'll talk another, you know, 3 hours if we get into
bring it back to... next year's Congress. And
yeah, right. I'm sure that'll be riveting. But musically, actually, I'm really working in earnest on a deeper focus on Spanish and bilingual music. GIA just recently hired a Hispanic editor. That's kind of been a gap, I would say, at GIA for a while, vis-a-vis the church as it is in places South and the West. And we had another podcast interview with Peter Kolar, who's just an incredible gift to all of us. And his presence there has made me really want to delve more deeply into that. And especially, well, one of the things that we keep coming back to is there's no kind of general Latino music, right?
Yeah, it's just because it's in Spanish doesn't mean it resonates with that particular community.
That's right. There's a deep plurality there. And so much of the music we sing in the U.S. praying church is either from Mexico or Spain. Very beautiful music, but I've been really interested in exploring what it might be like to explore it from a Cuban perspective.
Yeah.
And so I've been kind of experimenting. We'll see how it goes with music that kind of takes seriously that particular cultural heritage.
Have you been back there?
I have.
Do you still have relatives?
I don't have relatives there. They all either went to Spain or the U.S.
Okay.
But about 2 years ago, my father and I took a trip back.
Oh, is that great? Oh, that's wonderful.
And it was his first visit since he left under duress when he was 6 years old.
Wow.
And so it was an extremely emotional experience.
Yeah, I bet.
And you know, you're like my therapist here. Probably one of the things that pulled me towards this project was that visit.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that wanting to connect and kind of bring those parts of myself
it's
together.
Funny how, you know, as you'll find out in 30 years when you get my age, but there is that yearning to figure out your past, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's taking their DNA tests now and all this stuff. But it's that little bit of our culture was so closed off to us, you know? There was a certain generation that went there all the time, movie stars and Ricky Ricardo.
That's right.
You know, but that's kind of the only piece we knew. Did you attend liturgy while you were there?
We did. We went to Mass in the cathedral in La Habana.
Like?
I mean, it was interesting. It was pretty simple musically. There was a young woman kind of playing a little electronic organ, singing some things that were familiar to me that we sing that was from Spain. Beautiful church, not enormous.
Did she know Tony Alonso's music?
I did not ask her that. That's not a question.
Sure,
do you know this piece?
Have you seen my new song?
I went up and told them that I thought it was beautiful and that I appreciated their leadership, but that's all. But being there was a remarkable experience. And, you know, as a lover of Cuban music my whole life, my grandfather used to give me cassettes of Cuban music listen to this. So I would. And I've been really paying attention to the fact that so much of it's very dialogical, like liturgy.
Yeah.
You'll have like a soloist call and then a kind of repetitive refrain for the coro. And so I've been thinking about how to put that to liturgical use in productive ways. So
it sounds quite different than Mexican music.
Very different.
Yeah.
Very different. The instrumentation is different. Everything is different. I mean, a lot of Cuban music foregrounds the piano, whereas a lot of Mexican music foregrounds the guitar.
Right. Oh, so keyboard is more predominant.
Not in all, but in a lot of recent Cuban music. So this is kind of a fun...
show all of us. Yeah.
It's a lot of kind of experimenting, I would say. I feel a little bit out of my depths, which is exciting for an artist to kind of try something.
It's always good
where
to try something new rather than just crank out the next piece.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I have found problematic about our kind of model of liturgical music publishing has been the idea of a liturgical music collection where it has to be 12 or 14 songs, because not all of us write 12 to 14 good songs, maybe even in a lifetime, let alone in a year over 2 years.
The same collection or the same. I feel the same way about Mass parts, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, I love the Gloria from this, but really the Sanctus and the Mystery are kind of blah.
Right.
You know, or they have all the same melody for the entire Mass. And I find myself doing maybe the Eucharistic acclamations mm-hmm. as from one composer and the Gloria and the Kyrie from another. Or,
right.
You but know, the idea that somebody can write an entire Mass is
a daunting thing.
It's a daunting thing.
Yeah. And so for me, I mean, I've heard so many people, even that I really respect and whose music I love, where there'll be like one amazing piece and then 12 not so amazing pieces. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of took that as a challenge personally to say, hey, don't just write something to write something. Write something because you think it serves a need, or you feel so passionate about it that you can't do it. And so I've been trying to think more functionally that way about my music. And there's tons of music that I've written that will never see the light of day because I just don't think it really, to my mind, meets that bar. So this project is exciting me because every song is kind of like an exciting thing.
A new baby to me. And how much time do you spend composing? Do you allot a little bit of time each day? Or, I mean, it sounds like you have a very busy academic life.
Yeah, it's super varied. In fact, when I went on for my PhD at Emory, many people said, so are you still going to write music or are you just going to focus on academics?
Yeah, I thought that would go away.
And I was very open, I didn't say what's open to it going away, but I was open to it receding a bit, which can happen, and that's totally fine, the life of a composer. But what ended up happening was, because the academic stuff was so in my head, and I would spend hours writing academic essays, I found that inevitably, at the completion of an academic essay, a song would come.
Oh, okay.
Almost like I needed to express something that the words could not contain.
I love it.
Not necessarily even directly related to the topic of the essay, but just needed to express.
There was a little music going on in your head that
exactly.
had to come out.
So I ended up writing quite a lot over those PhD years. Now, without the space of like where you're just writing and being a student all day, but you have administrative responsibilities, mm-hmm. I'm finding it more of a challenge. So we'll see.
Well, it's the same as a performing musician, you know? I mean, the idea that I'm going to play all these giant pieces that I used to play 20 years ago and try to run this great big program, that's why you bring in a David Ball right out of Juilliard who still has all those big pieces in his hand.
And that's all they do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He just practices and prepares all the masses and choir anthems and recordings and plays concerts all over. And, you know, I'm past that stage. I grew out of that stage.
Well, I'm sure you could do it if you got rid of all the other stuff.
Well, every now and then I do, you know, and I really have to focus in, you know. Once or twice a year, I still play a program. And besides just Sunday music, you know, it's kind of a task. You know, I've got to force myself into doing it. So, well, I'm glad you're not forcing yourself into composing. I'm glad you're still composing and
it's become kind of a happy hobby, actually.
Yeah. Well, this has just been an absolute delight to get to know you a little better, to get to have you here on the campus. I hope this will be the first of many visits, and that we'll hear more about this program as it develops and your own writing style and your Cuban project and all the other things coming up in your life. Tony, thank you for being with us. This has just been absolutely wonderful.
My delight. Thank you so much, John.
Oh, thank you. How about one more piece?
Sure. This is a piece. One of my other commitments is kind of paying attention to the treasury of mystics and saints and beautiful writings that we've had throughout history that kind of are underexplored, I think, liturgically. So this is a piece that draws on a Celtic mystic and Thomas Merton. And it's a song I wrote that I think has particular resonance for people kind of searching for a new path in life. its refrain is based on the Psalms. I will lift my eyes to the mountain.
Psalm 121.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, with that note, we will lift our eyes up to our beautiful mountains, filled at this time of the year with snow. And Tony, thank you again for being with us. As always, we encourage you to get out and hear some great music in live performance. And maybe that live performance will include a composition of Tony Alonso. We'll see you on the next episode of Music from the Tower. Thanks for joining us today. And this is John Romeri here on Relevant Radio. Thanks so much for being with us.
It is time for me to move from my shelter of safety, sail as a pilgrim over the waves of the sea. It is time to be still and to seek the Son of Mary. Time to rest, time to leave behind. find my fears. And I will not fear the storm, though it rages around me, for slowly I am learning to place my trust in you, to forgive every hurt and to loosen every burden, to let go and to follow where you lead. I will lift my eyes to the mountains, from where shall come my help? My help shall certain that I follow where you lead. Still I trust that my desire to please you will guide me, and I trust that you will keep me from harm. I will lift my eyes to the mountains, from where shall come my help. My help shall come from the Lord. So I'll walk in the light of the path set before me, for I know your love will show. My fears alone.